Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
...and killing 52-year-old Hashim Ibrahim Awad in Hamdaniya, Iraq, in April, and then planting an AK-47 next to his body to make it look as if he was an insurgent. For the latest on this case and a look at the status of others, Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for UPI, is first up today. And Pam, the facts of this case have been pretty sparse. What's going to happen today?
Today's an Article 32 hearing, which in the civilian world is akin to a grand jury hearing or a preliminary hearing, and it's going to lay out the evidence that they have against the eight accused. The defense lawyers for the accused have tried to get it so that they didn't have an Article 32 hearing and they could move right into a court-martial, but the Marine Corps refused.
By the way, why would they do that?
That's an interesting question. There are a couple explanations for it, but I think the main one might be that when you have an Article 32 hearing, actual facts come out. It's a public hearing, and the evidence gets laid out. These defense attorneys have been doing exactly what they're supposed to do and vigorously defending their clients. But I think what they've wanted to do is really set up this as a debate in the media and in the public eye as being, you know, about Marines and a Navy corpsman who were, you know, out there protecting themselves, protecting their buddies, and doing what they did for U.S. national security rather than being portrayed as a murderer. So it's better for them not to have facts in the case come out because they want to shape the case in the press. The government is at a disadvantage in this situation because until an Article 32 hearing, they can't reveal any of the evidence. So it's pretty much all the defense lawyers' playing field.
Ah, and so the defense lawyers have actually been complaining that they haven't had much information to work with, but is that because of the setup of the Article 32?
I think that's how it works out. There's the Article 32, the government will lay out all of the evidence that it's gathered, and at that point they will have complete access to it. It's an odd choice not to have an Article 32 because it's one of the premier ways that the U.S. military protects the rights of the defendants, because at this point they could just kick this case out of court if they say there's not enough evidence to take these guys to court. So an Article 32 is really good if you're innocent.
Well, and what's going to happen today is it will be determined if this does go to trial. Reports have said that five of the troops are being accused of shooting Mr. Awad, and all eight are being charged because prosecutors say they were complicit in that killing.
Right. Three of them, I think, didn't report what happened.
What are defense attorneys saying about their clients?
They're saying basically that these guys are, you know, in the hunt for insurgents, that this guy was a threat to them, and they had to take the action that they did.
They're also saying that their clients were coerced into giving statements.
The men were initially in a maximum security prison. They were separated, and they were interrogated pretty much from dawn till dawn. They've been claiming that they've been sort of mistreated in that way.
What impact has this case had on morale?
This case has had an interesting impact on morale, I think, back here, less so in the field from the people that I'm talking to. They're just sort of plowing ahead and doing what they need to do. But back here, it certainly plays into politics. This is, as you know, an increasingly unpopular war, and there are people who are using this situation as evidence, so to speak, that, you know, this is an unjust war and that things have gotten dangerously out of hand and we should just pull out our troops. The fact is, though, that this is actually a fairly common occurrence in war. In World War II, there were at least 300 Americans who, during the war and in the subsequent years, were executed for murder, rapes, and kidnappings. The military draws its numbers from the population, and in doing so, it nets up people who might have criminal tendencies or who are not terribly stable, and the pressures of war can make them do things like this. One of the overarching questions, though, is whether or not the military has been sufficiently aggressive in investigating, or if it's just taking the word of troops until counter-information comes out in the press, which is the case of what happened in Haditha.
And this case that's going into a hearing today in San Diego, some are saying, is sort of a prelude to a possible trial of the 12 Marines accused of killing 24 Iraqi civilians in Haditha, Iraq. What is the status of that case?
Right, that occurred back last November. They are still reading through voluminous reports feet-high worth of documents back in Camp Pendleton, where they will ultimately face trial if they do, here in the Pentagon, as well as down in Tampa, where Central Command is. And they're trying to figure out how to go forward. It's a more difficult situation because there's so many more people involved, more time has passed, and there's two parts to the investigation. One is the criminal investigation, which has its own difficulties because the military and the Marine Corps in particular doesn't want to create a situation where troops have to second-guess their instincts in battle. So they need to figure out if these guys killed people in a premeditated way or if their state of mind at the time was genuinely that they were under attack and if they exercised proper restraint and if they followed the rules of engagement. So it's a hard thing that they're going to have to look at. The second part of this investigation is one that's perhaps a little bit more cut and dried and one that's even actually more serious to the military as an institution, and that's whether or not the chain of command covered up or didn't sufficiently investigate what had happened. They put out a press release back in November that I remember getting and thinking, wow, that's an awfully big bomb, where they said 15 civilians were killed by a roadside bomb. That's quite different from what actually happened. And somehow the information of what actually happened didn't make it out, and instead this press release was put out giving a completely different version of events. So they're looking at how that could have happened and why didn't the battalion commander know what was going on in that unit to be able to correct that, to say, hey, that's not true, we have to take that back. So I'm not sure when it's been scheduled to go forward. There hasn't been an Article 32 in that one yet either.
A hearing. Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for UPI, speaking to us about a possible upcoming trial concerning Marines in Haditha, Iraq, and also about today's hearing at Camp Pendleton, San Diego, where eight servicemen are accused of killing an innocent Iraqi civilian. Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Downgraded to a tropical depression, Ernesto is now heading north out of Florida, the storm not seen as a major threat, but North and South Carolina have mobilized National Guard troops as a precaution. And New Orleans is breathing a sigh of relief. Continuing our look at the city a year after Katrina, we look today at the elderly, many kept by red tape from rebuilding their homes or returning to the area. Howard Rogers III is director of the New Orleans Council on Aging. And Howard, what is the biggest problem facing seniors there?
Well, some of the problems that seniors are facing here in post-Katrina New Orleans, the number one is housing. There still is a lack of housing for seniors throughout the city. Prior to the storm, there were about 15 to 20 sites where seniors lived in congregate housing situations, high-rise apartment buildings and low-rise apartment buildings. And in fact, in some of those particular buildings, we had meal sites where those individuals who lived there would come down during the middle of the day, get a hot meal, and then go back to their apartment or go back to what they were doing. So housing is still a critical need for seniors outside of, for everybody else here in the city.
Well, we understand that many of those seniors that you mentioned are being housed by FEMA in trailers and have no way of getting to the services you just mentioned, the community meals.
Right. They don't. In fact, there are several trailer parks around the city where seniors are, and unfortunately, we lost our main kitchen during the storm. It was flooded. And we've been receiving meals from our caterer from Mississippi. We hope that by the middle of September, that their kitchen will be up and running again in New Orleans.
And that's a long time. I mean, that's well over a year
right after
Katrina. We understand that some of the elderly, because they're cut off from some services like food, are being forced into nursing homes sooner than they would normally go.
Well, actually, what happened was right after the storm, while the evacuation was going on right after the storm from the people who they took from the convention center and the Astrodome, those seniors who lived independently were taken to those facilities, and it was determined by whoever was there that those individuals go into nursing homes. So people were kind of forced to go into nursing homes. And what has happened is a lot of those seniors are trying to come out, but again, they don't have a place to live. So naturally, they're staying there in the nursing home until either a relative can find a place for them to stay. Some of them don't want to stay in a FEMA trailer. It's very uncomfortable living in a tin box. And I don't know if you've heard this in your part of the country, but it's been determined that the FEMA trailers that we are occupying have high levels of formaldehyde in them.
Yeah.
So we're looking at some more health issues later on in the next year or two after people have spent their time in their FEMA trailer.
Well, and in the meantime, seniors are also cut off from so many of the other services that we take for granted, that are life supports for them, such as?
Such as hospitals and mental health, and especially services for assisted living in their homes, such as home health care agencies. We had a very tremendous homemakers program at the Council on Aging that we provided 60 to 70 visits a week to individuals and helping them keep their homes clean. Well, we don't have our homemakers anymore. Another major problem that the seniors are having and everybody's having here in the city, and that has to deal with the availability of medical services. There are only two major hospitals open in the city of New Orleans. Charity Hospital, which was basically the walk-in clinic for the indigent, the poor, and the elderly, is closed, and its trauma unit has moved to a hospital in the nearby parish of Jefferson. So it's hard for individuals to find adequate medical services in the city of New Orleans a year after the storm.
We heard those. To me, there were some of the worst stories during Katrina of seniors who died because they couldn't get out of the water, they couldn't get out of a ward, they couldn't get their medicine. Do you think seniors are, you know, dying now in an American city, in New Orleans, because they don't have the services that they'd have in another city?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And unfortunately, they're dying in other American cities, those who evacuated away from here, because they long to come back home. We've received phone calls of seniors away from here in Houston, Dallas, Atlanta, who are just telling us, find us a place to come back home because I don't want to die here. And so you can, you know, from that conversation, you can get the despair on that individual's mind that they feel as though that they're in a they're in the United States, but it's not home. It's a strong attachment to this place. I don't know if it's in the water or it's in the air, but it's kind of hard getting New Orleans out of here. And especially if you've been here all of your life, you never got a chance to travel and see other parts of the world, all you know is New Orleans. And for a lot of seniors, that's all they know is New Orleans. And they want to come home. And because of that, some of them are actually grieving themselves to death.
Howard Rogers III, he's director of the New Orleans Council on Aging. Well, just ahead, the other end of the age spectrum, rebuilding Tulane University. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Getting New Orleans back on its feet, but learning institutions do bring in dollars spent, and they bring a lot of respect to a city. And Cowan toured the country trying to lure his students back. Here's what Tu had to say after listening to his pitch here in Boston.
And I think that people are getting all of us, the five freshmen here at Harvard who want to stay, I think they're getting our story wrong by thinking that we've fallen in love with the prestige of the school, but I've really just fallen in love with the community that happens to be at Harvard. I love my roommates, I love my dorm, my classes, my teachers. I've just felt so accepted here. I feel like it's really my home institution. Just having to leave here is going to be really hard because I've bonded so much with everyone.
I want to go back because when I visited the school, I fell in love with it, and that's the only school I wanted to go to. I don't want to go anywhere else. I don't want to stay here.
Well, what did they all ultimately decide? Tulane University President Scott Cowan joins us now on the line from New Orleans. And Scott, how many students are coming back?
Of the students that were here last spring,
the vast majority, matter of fact, 97% of them came back this fall, which is comparable to the return rate we would have seen in prior years. So we really didn't lose any students from last spring to this fall.
And let's remind ourselves of what it was like for students in particular last year. I remember you were housing some of the students on a cruise ship outside the city.
Absolutely. Last spring, housing was really was not plentiful at all. So we brought in a cruise ship that was able to house about 1,200 people. And we used that really as our transition housing all during the spring. Fortunately, by the end of the spring, we had enough housing built on campus, temporary housing, plus the neighborhood cleared up much faster than we thought it would. So there turned out to be plenty of housing by June or July for students.
Well, remind us, how much of the school was underwater, first of all? How much damage was there? And in dollars, how much damage was there?
Overall, the total damage from the storm, that includes operating losses and physical damage, is in excess of $400 million.
Mm.
And two-thirds of our campus was underwater. And all of our health science campus, which is at a different location, was underwater.
And how are the facilities now?
The facilities look and feel as good, if not better, than they did pre-Katrina. And students who came back to campus said, this place looks fabulous.
Well, and Scott, that begs a question, because as we've been hearing for the past couple of weeks, a lot of New Orleans isn't rebuilt, and people haven't been able to even get their basements cleaned out. How is it? Is it because you're a private institution that you were able to do this so quickly?
Well, you know, first of all, Robin, New Orleans is a tale of two cities right now. 60% of the city is functioning very well, looks and feels very much like it did pre-Katrina. Tulane operates in that 60%. The reason we were able to do it so quickly is, quite honestly, is we just made some very hard decisions very early on to say, listen, we have to open up in January. Our facilities have to be ready. And we're just going to do this no matter what the cost is or what the sacrifice is.
How are you paying for this?
Well, right now, of the $400 million, we received about $100 million in insurance recovery, and we're in lawsuits with the rest of our insurers for the rest of the money. In the meantime, we had to go out and borrow $150 million.
That's a big line of credit.
That's above and beyond our line of credit, because we also have a line of credit that's equivalent to the same amount. So between our lines of credit as well as the money that we borrowed, that's how we're handling the cash flow during this transition period of time.
How are you, how are you going to, ultimately make up that money?
Well, we believe that in the end, between insurance and FEMA payments, we will recuperate virtually all of that $300 million we're still out of pocket. So we're very optimistic that insurance and FEMA will cover that gap, but it may take 3 to 5 years to get to that point.
Why is it important to rebuild a school? And again, as you said, this is a tale of two cities. Half the city hasn't been rebuilt. Why is it that important to get a school back on its feet?
Well, Tulane University has been around for 172 years. It's one of the major research universities in the country. It has a distinguished alumni group, and it has a very storied history. And it is, in the South in particular, and nationally, one of the premier institutions. So we owed it to our city, to our region, to the country, to all of our alumni to get the school up and running again as quickly as we could and preserve its reputation and its quality that really was built up over 172 years. And the good news is we've done that.
Did you ever consider moving the school?
No, never. To move Tulane from New Orleans would be, similar to taking the Statue of Liberty from New York. You just don't consider that. It's not the same.
Since, Hurricane Katrina also, sort of ripped the facade off a lot of class and other kinds of issues in the city, has Tulane thought about increasing the scholarship and the ability for kids from New Orleans to go to the school?
Well, we've always had programs that allowed kids from Louisiana and in particular New Orleans to come. And we will look for those opportunities over time. For example, during this past year, we actually chartered our own set of schools. And we'll probably create more opportunities for high schoolers in those charter schools we have to come to Tulane while they're in high school and take some courses. So I do think that over time, we'll provide more opportunities for academically gifted students from New Orleans to attend Tulane University, both while they're in high school, but then on a permanent basis.
Scott Cowan is president of Tulane in New Orleans. Scott, thanks for speaking with us, and have a good year.
All right. Thank you very much, Robin.
behind this news note, U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is drawing historical parallels between World War II and today. Speaking at the American Legion's National Convention in Salt Lake City yesterday, Rumsfeld spoke of how some nations tried to appease Adolf Hitler before World War II and said it would be folly for the U.S. to do the same today.
Someone recently recalled one U.S. senator's reaction in September of 1939. Upon hearing that Hitler had invaded Poland to start World War II, he exclaimed, "Lord, if only I had talked to Hitler, all of this might have been avoided." Unquote. I recount that history because once again we face similar challenges in efforts to confront the rising threat of a new type of fascism.
Democrats are crying foul. Rumsfeld's speech is part of a series of addresses by senior Bush officials leading up to the fifth anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science, Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide, mos.org/NCTL.
...of girls struggling with substance abuse, eating disorders, and aggressive behavior. Katrina, who asked that we not use her last name, was one of these students. She spent more than 2 years in Jermaine Lawrence for cocaine and opium addictions. Katrina is now 17 years old. She completed the rehab program at the school this summer and recorded an audio diary of her last days there.
It's Tuesday, 24th, 10:15 at night, and I can't sleep because I have 3 more days and 2 more nights until I leave this program, and my nerves are whew, but I'm also nervous about like going out and staying sober and stuff, but I can do it. I've come this far. I know I can do it, but the nights just waiting here, it's like, oh, I just want to go home. This is my room. You come right in. It's like seriously a 2x2. It sucks, but yeah, sometimes this room's depressing, you know, just remind you of where you are, your home, you know, you ain't home, you don't feel like these people love you, it's different, and it's like every time I lie down to bed, I thank God that I'm sober and stuff, you know, like that I'm gonna be leaving soon, but it's like a newsflash, like I'm still in a program, and it's just like, well, how the hell did I get in here?
Like whatever they say has no bearing. It's so scary in a house that allows no swearing. To see him walking around.
Before I was at everyone's throats. I was miserable, stayed in my room, lied. And then things just blew up. I just stopped going to school. So my mom searched my room. She found all a bunch of drug stuff, all the cigarettes, all everything. That was it. That was my last night. I haven't been home since that night. Today is Wednesday, the 25th, and it is too early to even get up and look at my watch. I didn't sleep at all last night. Today's my goodbye party. I'm probably going to cry today. I didn't think saying goodbye would be so hard, but it is. My school called yesterday, the school I'm going to be going to, and they told me all my classes and stuff. That was pretty cool. It pisses me off because it's a behavioral school, and I honestly don't think I need a behavioral school. I want to be so challenged. I want to make something of my life. So I had to keep my act together, not screw up, because I do not want to come back to this place. I learned my lesson, and a bunch more that I didn't intend on learning. I really got my act together, so that's pretty cool. It's actually really cool. I'm actually really proud of myself. I don't give myself enough credit, I don't think. Well, that's what they tell me, and I don't really think that, but...
Katrina?
What?
Meds.
I'm coming. Yeah, I gotta go before I get in trouble. Peace.
This
is Thursday the 26th. It is my last night here, and we are going on my last van ride to AA.
Go get some recovery, ladies. For life. We're having some sober fun. I am 1 year and 2 months sober.
How long am I sober?
Yeah.
She's counting.
Oh. 5 days sober. Woo!
He's sober, you.
I say 18 months and a couple days. Yeah, that's what.
I've been sober too long, but it's good sober. Today is Thursday, 27th. Today's Friday the 27th, and it is 3:01. I'm supposed to be leaving here at 3 for good. My mom should be here any minute. My stuff's all packed. Someone's flipping all downstairs, which sucks because it's my last day leaving. This is my therapist.
Hi, Katrina.
How do you feel about me leaving?
I'm sad. I've only known Katrina a couple of months, but I'm really sad that she's leaving.
My mom's late.
It's 3:01.
She's late. See, this is what we were talking about.
No.
My mom's here.
Oh, now
some girl's flipping out.
That's why we came upstairs.
5 years, North Carolina College, University, getting my veterinarian degree, and playing for the Tar Heel soccer team. Going upstairs, get the rest of my stuff. My mom would be paid back for all the stuff I spent, the money I stole from her. That she doesn't even know about yet. Give me a hug! One day I'm just gonna spring it on her. With all the money.
Don't come back here.
Oh, trust me, I won't. Which is probably like only 150, but I'm gonna give her like 500. Be like, I stole money from you before. And this is my makeup for it, you know? I just wanna give her the world. I have so much crap!
Congratulations.
Thank you for everything.
Of course.
Have fun. Okay, bye, girl.
Bye.
This is me going home. Bye. This is me driving out. Going out the driveway. This is Katrina. It's been about 2 weeks since I've been home. My house is really, like, quiet and cozy. I like it. We have a lot of people here. My dog is really fat. Jermaine Lawrence really taught me a lot. Turned my life around. Saved my life, as my mom would say it. Which is... I needed it. Felicia's making mac and cheese. Felicia, how old are you?
18.
Felicia's my sister. We were adopted together, best friends. Not always. Felicia and me did not get along at all before because I was making bad choices. My sister knew it, and she loved me.
Felicia loves me. Don't you love me, Felicia? Yep.
While you're in there, you're always like, oh, this is my teenage years, and like I'm wasting it in a program.
Hi, Mikey.
But honestly, you have the whole rest of your life, and I'd rather be alive for those rest of my life than, like, party it up as a teenager. And not a lot of girls see that.
That's why I'm like,
he's gonna be alright, just gotta keep holding on, and you'll make it through tonight, he's gonna be okay.
Katrina, one of roughly 200,000 children under the age of 19 admitted to substance abuse centers annually in the U.S., according to the Department of Health and Human Services. Katrina was at the Jermaine Lawrence School in Arlington, Massachusetts. She says she's still sober and will return to high school as a junior in September. Her audio diary was produced by independent producer Lee Fuoco and Here and Now's Matt Largy. Coming up, Dr. Robin Cook, not just a physician, also a medical mystery writer. You're listening to Here and Now. A picture in the Boston Globe today caught our eye. Two young boys riding in the back seat of their car, sitting between them, their dad wearing army fatigues. Wait a minute.
He looks awfully thin. Wait a minute. On closer inspection, he's a cutout, a life-size picture. Welcome to the flat daddy, flat mommy phenomenon. The popular family support program run by the Maine National Guard is providing life-size cutouts of deployed servicemen and women to their families. Deborah Hansen of Calais, Maine, has one of the cutouts. Her husband, Len, is on his second tour of duty in Iraq with the Maine National Guard. And Deborah, where is flat Len right now?
He is sitting up against the wall waiting for his next adventure.
Where are some of the places you've taken Flatland?
Earlier this spring, there was a candlelight vigil in an area town, and I took him down there, and it was a military vigil. And it was interesting to see. He was pretty popular because a friend of mine brought her a flat daddy, a husband cutout also. And they were entertaining to the crowd, but it also made them realize that they are real people that are serving overseas.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the other places you have taken him?
My daughter, Hillary, had an eighth grade celebration that my husband missed. And so she took the flat daddy and had her photo taken with him. And it's a small school she goes to, so everybody had known him, the real Len, when he was here. So they were actually coming up and talking to it and looking at it and doing pictures with him.
We understand from the Globe article that these flat daddies sit at the dinner table, they go for rides. Some children have even taken them to confession.
Oh, wow. Well, we took ours to church one time. He's gone to just a road trip to go visit relatives. He was strapped in the back. They're very fragile. They're on foam core board that you buy at a craft store. So you have to be careful of. You know, you can't stack things on them, and you can't have them lean with weight because they will crack.
Oh, which would be awful. I know you have grown kids and kids at home and a grandchild.
My granddaughter, Cadence, I got her a cutout of my husband, and it's her papa. She calls him papa. And we were hoping that this would help her keep in touch visually with what he looks like while he's away since she's so young. And the day I brought it home to her, I put it down on her level, and she went up and said, Papa, and gave him a nice kiss. And it's her Papa Flat Daddy.
Well, you know, we're having some fun, but as, you know, that points out, it's a pretty serious topic. I can't imagine what it's like to have a loved one at war. Does this really help?
It does. This second deployment, we did not have a Flat Daddy on his first one, so it kind of lightens up a little when you do go somewhere and bring it. Because people will tend to ask how he is, like he's away on a vacation fishing, like he's having a great time. So it's kind of, it puts a face to all the people that are over there. It makes it more real, I think, to a lot of people that just assume soldiers are soldiers, that, you know, families, this is what we have. We don't have the real person. We have this flat daddy for the next year of our lives.
Right. And you do keep in touch. You know, it's so different in Iraq as opposed to previous conflicts. There's email, snapshots, video phone. Mm-hmm. What about you, though? Why is this helpful for you?
Well, this deployment being different than the last, I don't really have as regular contact with him as I did before, because his mission's, you know, different. So it's kind of nice to walk by, and, you know, he's always smiling. You know, across the room, there's his flat daddy always looking, and it's kind of a nice thing to see, you know, after maybe a bad day. It's nice to go by his flat daddy, and his face is just there smiling at me, even though I haven't had a chance to have contact with him that day.
Oops.
I have a beep on my phone.
Yeah. Do you want to get that and then come back?
It's actually my husband.
Oh,
so I'm going to go.
Oh, please do.
Okay.
Deborah Hansen, Calais, Maine, about to talk to the real Len as opposed to the flat daddy. Deborah, thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And to see pictures of the flat daddies and mommies from the Maine National Guard, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. We'll be right back. topic is concierge medicine. Physicians available to patients 24/7 for an annual membership fee, which can range from $1,500 to $20,000 a year. It would be against insurance regulations for that to be construed as a premium. So the concierge companies offer a list of services insurance companies don't provide, such as elaborate yearly exams and nutrition counseling. But the biggest perk? Time. In the novel Crisis, Craig Bowman is a Boston-based doctor with a midlife crisis and a concierge practice. After a patient dies, he served with a malpractice lawsuit. On trial, Dr. Bowman, but also concierge medicine. Joining us in the studio with more on his book and on his opinion on concierge medicine is Dr. Robin Cook. Welcome.
Thank you.
What made you take on this topic?
Well, I kind of like to choose topics that people don't know too much about, and yet topics that I think are really going to affect medicine. And this is one of them, concierge medicine.
Well, tell us more about it. I mean, you know, we understand that it's doctors who set up these almost private practices and people pay these annual fees.
What it is that doctors have decided that they would charge people to be a member of a practice. And what the people were really paying for was that the doctor decided to limit his practice. And they'll say they'll give them nutrition counseling, they'll give them very elaborate yearly physicals, et cetera, et cetera. But what they're really giving them is access. And the way they can give that access is by limiting the practice. And ergo, from that comes the problem.
The problem being?
The problem being is it's already not that easy to find a good primary care physician, particularly in certain markets. And those markets where concierge medicine is having a big inroad, like Naples, Florida, is one, it is now very much, much more difficult, in fact, almost impossible for somebody to find a good primary care physician without paying that kind of upfront fee.
Because this is taking doctors out of the pool of doctors who would treat patients.
That's right. So, in other words, you take somebody with a practice, let's say they have 3,000 people in their practice, and they say, all right, I've had enough, I'm fed up, whatever. I'm going to start a concierge practice. I'm going to limit it to 500 people. What happens to the other 2,500?
Well, this is the case of your fictional Dr. Craig Bowman, who says that he wants to go into concierge medicine because of the way he's been forced to practice by insurance companies. Tell us a little more about that, because you seem to agree that there's something completely out of whack with the healthcare system and the amount of time that doctors are allotted to see patients.
Well, it's particularly with primary care. I don't think a lot of people realize that primary care physicians are reimbursed a very small flat fee for a visit to a primary care physician. Now, that means if they get $50 plus to see someone, that doesn't make any difference whether the person has something as simple as a runny nose and it's a healthy person and whatnot, it's very quick, or somebody comes in and has multitude of problems, has to have long explanation, has to be seen by specialists, long conversations with the family and with the patient, et cetera. And it's gotten to the point because of elevated costs in terms of practice location for employees that it's getting so that it's hard for these people to maintain a positive flow of money.
Well, it's also why you only get maybe 15 minutes with a doctor nowadays.
And
it's
if why, you're lucky,
if 15 you're lucky. Minutes. And it's why they have to make more referrals because they can't talk to you about problems that you may have. And so you end up getting, as you write, MRIs or CAT scans because the doctor doesn't have the time to look
to at do
the problem.
It himself or herself. In other words, refers you on. Whereas perhaps it might be better if they talk to you and found out what your problem is, what is your complaint, and since they know you better, their doctor, et cetera, it just sort of makes a lot of sense.
But then you now have Dr. Craig Bowman, your fictional concierge doctor, who could now possibly be saying, be careful what you wish for, because he now has this private concierge practice, but now he has patients who demand to see him for hours at a time.
That's right.
And it's sort of the flip side of what
you're
talking about.
And one of the ironies in Crisis is that the doctor gets sued for making a house call. That's one of the amenities that concierge doctors will provide. And one would think that, well, this is such a patient-oriented phenomena, they certainly wouldn't get sued for that. That's part of the irony of the story.
There are several others, which we won't get into because it sort of, you know, gives we don't want to give away the ending. One of them is, and you write about it in your author's notes, apparently you're represented, you say, by one of the characters, one of the fictional characters. It's a doctor that testifies, an expert witness against concierge practices at this trial of your fictional doctor. But you also write that while he represents your thinking, if you were in practice today, you would want to be one.
Isn't that hypocritical?
Well, explain that.
Well, if I was in primary care today, there's no doubt I would want to practice in the circumstance of as a primary care physician, because if you have to see one patient every 5 or 10 minutes in order to make enough money to stay in business, you're not going to be able to be the kind of doctor that you're trained to be.
But on the other hand, you are one of those saying, and the ending of your book clearly points to your thinking, that concierge medicine is also a big problem.
It's a problem in terms of what it's doing to accessibility. It's also a problem because it flies in the face of one of the basic principles of medicine, and that is that you don't show any discrimination in terms of who you take care of. And in the situation with concierge medicine, you're really skewing it towards the people with money. So socioeconomic status then is determining who it is that the concierge medicine is seeing, and that flies in the face of professionalism.
Right. But by the way, you suggest how the system might be fixed and there might be no need for concierge medicine, and that is that you suggest that there be more of a sliding scale on how doctors are paid instead of $50 per 15-minute visit, that they be paid
by the hour.
By the hour, how long a visit has to go.
That's how we pay all our other professionals.
But the questions about that would be, well, first of all, doesn't that mean that the older you are and the sicker you are, the more you have to pay?
But most people aren't paying out of their pocket anyway. They have insurance. It's insurance companies that are paying. The real problem is that our healthcare system has been skewed in the direction of specialty care and procedures. This is at the same time not recognizing the input that is so important from primary care. We have this fragmented, discontinuous healthcare system, mostly with specialists, which is like a labyrinth for the normal individual to kind of find their way in. They need a primary care physician to, in a certain sense, guide them through this system. We should be paying our primary care physicians more than we should be paying our specialty physicians.
Just one last question, though. If you were to pay a doctor, you know, for a 10-minute visit if that's all you needed, or a 40-minute visit if that's what you needed, you know, it would be clocked that way. I can't imagine the paperwork, you know, of trying to gauge each visit, of the millions of doctor's visits.
Well, it works in every other professional's office. We pay our lawyers that way. We pay our accountants that way. All our professionals, except our primary care physicians, and in a certain sense, they are the ones that we need more than any of the others, to tell you the honest truth.
Mm-hmm. Crisis, the new fiction novel from Robin Cook about the world of concierge medicine, also called luxury medicine. What are some of the other?
Yeah, retainer medicine, right. Boutique medicine. There's a lot of different names because it's so new. It's only been around for about 10 years.
Well, now listen, you could afford it. Would you never do it?
Well, I'm lucky. I mean, as a physician myself, I have access to all sorts of people, and I actually experience the kind of medicine that I wish that everyone in this country experienced.
Robin, thanks.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now. America's key ally in the war on terrorism, Pakistan, is rocked by civilian unrest. Also, the lost boys of polygamy, young men kicked out of their homes by dads who see them as competition for future wives. That's